This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum. And today we have five different people on the panel. We're going to be discussing economic and other arguments for obtaining rural community buy-in on renewable energy. The first person speaking will be Sherry Gruder from the University of Wisconsin. Next, David Kay from Cornell University. And Jason Kulishevsky from University of Buffalo Regional Institute. Robert Kester from Ball State University, and Michael Walton, Green Spaces, Chattanooga. So, Sherry, why don't you go ahead and start us out?
Okay.
A couple minutes each here.
So this will be short. I wanted to share in Wisconsin, I'm a statewide sustainable design and energy specialist. So a lot of the work that I do is with energy independent communities across the state, different communities. And what I find in the rural areas, which are doing really wonderfully in terms of installing renewable energy at multiple levels, for city or county operations, as well as assisting their businesses and their residents in getting solar, what I find is there are a number of drivers. And one of the big ones, of course, is dollar savings, but resource conservation and stewardship are among there. But I would say that one of the real main one that I hear the most is economic development. And under that, I include things like public visibility to attract residents and businesses, and not just to attract them, but to retain them. I think one of the biggest problems we're having here in Wisconsin is that they're losing their young people. Young people aren't moving there. They're moving more to the cities or where there are, you know, more high-tech jobs, and they have a very big elderly population. So attracting residents and businesses is a very big thing, and attracting the younger demographic. And then the other thing is to stay competitive with other cities and its and townships, because again, others are doing this and they want to be part of that, so that they can achieve the other benefits that they're looking for. And then I would say one other thing that I'm finding people are thinking about more now, although I wouldn't say it's the highest level driving factor, is resiliency. And it's the ability to improve their local energy security in the face of intense climate events. And here we, you know, luckily, we haven't had hurricanes, or wildfires so much. But we have had quite a bit of flooding and then drought, and extreme heat. So, anyway, I would say that the rural communities are doing a lot, and they are working, if they have a municipal utility or a rural co-op, an electric co-op, which many of them do, then they're using solar gardens. You know, some have been able to do wind projects, although that's really hard in our state to make happen anymore. And they really have been talking with their utilities about wanting to be able to purchase green power. And there are very large businesses that won't settle in places unless they have renewable energy available to them. So that's another driver, I think, that's helping utilities go along the pressure that they're getting from their municipalities and the businesses in the municipalities. And I would say one other thing, and that is that for the wind energy, in our state at least, not only do the landowners get annual amount of money for the use of their land to site the wind turbines, but we have a law that the municipalities also get funds And so it really brings in money to the local government. And so that's been really helpful. And even though there are a lot of people out there who don't even live in the local areas who will go out and fight a wind farm siting, when it works, everybody really prospers, and usually it's the biggest source of income to that community of anything else. So I guess that's it for now.
Well, I think it's amazing how much is going on in Wisconsin and all, so congratulations to you on that one. So David Kay from Cornell University in New York.
Hi. Yeah, I'm with the Community and Regional Development Institute at Cornell. I would say in just the couple minutes we have, the thing I would start with in addressing this question of obtaining rural community buy-in on renewables is focusing just on geography, where the renewable resource is and where the demand centers are. And what you have is another form of a very old interdependency showing up between urban consumers and rural producers, although, of course, there is some potential within urban areas for renewables and some demand in rural areas for energy. But the main point being that cities are not going to supply themselves with electricity and other energy sources. So just like with food and water and a lot of other things, there tends to be, at the very least, a regional interdependency between urban and rural. That is very important. A related topic is the density of renewable energy compared to the energy density of renewables compared to the energy density of fossil fuels. So essentially every form of renewable energy per kilowatt hour or per whatever unit of energy you prefer requires more space, which is something which is very scarce, more land area, more land use. That's something very scarce in urban areas, almost by definition, in rural areas. There is more land to provide the renewables, again, underscoring the importance of this interdependency. I'll also point, if you accept that, the critical importance and one of the major barriers in a lot of places, even if you have pretty optimistic expectations regarding the growth of distributed generation, there's still a really important question about transmission of energy, particularly electricity, from one source to another, and that requires lots of rural landowners and governments to buy in. And I think the last thing, just in a very brief introduction that I would draw attention to, is the increasing divides that relate to politics and identity between rural and urban populations and their value systems, their beliefs. And one of the things that I'm in the middle of a research project on now is trying to see whether the kind of polarization that had a rural-urban dimension to it, for sure, in New York at least, that occurred around the fracking debates is starting up now around deployment of solar energy in particular. So if we don't solve that problem, in New York at least we have local governments with siting authority who will make decisions that affect urban consumers about where they're going to be able to get their electricity and other energy sources from. So I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you, David. So we now have Jason Kulishevsky from University of Buffalo Regional Institute. Go ahead, Jason.
Hey, everybody. So, yeah, I definitely fully agree with what Sherry and David actually had to say, where some of the drivers are, you know, their economic development, you're looking for dollar savings and stewardship are the top three drivers. But I really feel like some of the issues that we face in rural areas particularly are issues that are affecting land use policies and zoning for solar. There's a fear of large-scale solar development in some of these rural communities where folks, you know, aren't really sure if it's a good thing for their community, if it's a bad thing. I think the studies on weather related to, you know, installing a solar farm to on former farmable crop land, and then 10, 25 years down the line, what does that land actually look like? You know, some communities that we're working with here in Western New York are really cautious of that. So there's been some moratorium on solar installations until they can go back and actually address their zoning and comprehensive planning and doing proper, you know, siting for some of these large-scale developments, because early on in the decade, we saw a pretty big boom in wind in Wyoming County here in Western New York, and there was a lot of activity happening, but it seemed to be like there was very little control and understanding about the long-term effects, visual sighting and aspects of this. So I think going into solar, there's more cautiousness and more caution moving ahead on large-scale projects. We do see it being more readily available for residential application than we are for large-scale. But New York State is currently working to encourage more municipalities to invest in large-scale solar operations that do kind of have some of those things that Sherry was talking about as well, like the economic development benefits of it and the community-based solar aspect, so that residents, you know, maybe they're not siting it on their own properties, but they're able to buy into a large-scale array so that they can still get green energy, but maybe they're just not installing it on their own properties. So these are just a couple of the issues that we're facing to try to get into the rural landscape, where, you know, they're a big driver for motivation for this is energy independence. You know, folks really want to be able to create and own their own energy. We hear a lot of folks talking about wanting to be off-grid, which is still not something that's legal in New York State. Everything in the state has to be grid-tied. So there are just little educational pieces that I think fall through the cracks sometimes in rural communities where maybe we're not reaching out or getting the right educational piece out there so that folks can understand the pros and cons. So what we do here at the Regional Institute is try to provide like template resolutions or show what other rural communities have done so that they can see that, you know, it's not something that definitely can't happen, and that there are other communities within our region that are really thinking about the long-term effects of implementing renewable projects and showing that it can be done in a responsible way so that landowners are protected and we're still generating enough energy to provide energy not only to our own communities, but like as David said, also, you know, being able to ship that energy out to more urban areas where there's a larger population density. So those are just some of the issues that I think that we face. And also in Western New York, we're kind of poised in a spot where our energy prices aren't as high as some other places, due to the fact that we are sitting on one of the renewable energy sources in the country at Niagara Falls. So communities sometimes find it hard to see the benefit of a payback if it's going to go out past 10 years. They don't see the benefit. They'd rather see a quicker return because municipalities here are already getting relatively cheap electricity to Niagara Falls and some of the current wind projects that we have here, too.
Okay. What I'd like to do, Sherry, are you still there? Sherry, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. I just muted my own phone.
Yes, no. Would you just, I know there's two other people that are, and Michael Walton's here too, I know that. Bob Hester, I'd like to hold you two for a minute here. Sherry has to leave, but my question to Sherry is, what did you say to these communities to get them involved in this in the first place? How did they get started in interest in solar in Wisconsin?
Well, in solar? Well, I would say that in 2009 and 10, under a different political regime in our state, there was grant money that was given to communities to move toward energy independence, which we defined as to generate 25% of your energy locally by 2025. We did that by a combination of engaging in planning and measure, you know, you had to establish a baseline and then reduce your energy use and then, you know, be able to generate 25% from local resources. So that led to a variety of things. We have some communities that have used, you know, biogas from their wastewater treatment plants. That's a big part of that, for instance. But So that was driving it. There's also a state focus on energy program, which is a public benefits program that provides grants, well, twice a year on when things are good, to help offset the cost of that. And but I think really another motivator is really the competition between cities. I think, you know, municipalities or townships, I think municipalities see what others are doing and they want to be part of that. So a lot of times the mayors have just contacted us and said, you know, we really need some help and we'd really like to be able to do this. Would you talk about a combination of things?
Okay, and I know you have to leave. I don't want to make you late either. We'll have Sherry back again to talk about some of these issues. They've done some very interesting things over in Wisconsin, but I wanted to hear from her on that topic at least before she left. So, Robert Kester,
Director
of Studies in Ball State University, would you like to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've done over there?
Sure.
And Ball State itself has an interesting geothermal project, so you might want to mention that.
I might suggest that everybody mute their phones because we're getting a lot of background noise. I'm not sure what.
I was just going to say that. You beat me to it, but good. Okay.
So the Center for Energy Research, Education, and Service at Ball State has been advancing green power in several different ways. We've migrated from being primarily an energy-focused entity to dealing more with the breadth of sustainability, and we recognize that the social, economic, and environmental dimensions all mix together. So economic development has been a big watchword of late, and we're well beyond now the argument about smokestack chasing as a means of rural development, that's not very useful, that instead the way to attract or retain folks in a rural community is through advancing the quality of place or the primacy of place. And sustainability becomes a metric by which one can actually live and ethic. And so one can promote the quality and primacy of place through stewardship, which was mentioned earlier, and certainly free energy from the sun, either sun or solar or wind, becomes a backbone for that. And, of course, resilience is a consideration, and energy independence factors in, as was described. The thing that we've found pretty helpful is to talk in terms of individual buildings or community districts as being similar to a leaf on a tree. As we know, the way in which trees operate is that the leaves are the real power plant. They're the ones sequestering carbon and generating oxygen. and feeding material to the tree to help it grow and prosper. Rather than treating buildings or communities as being at the end of the line on a grid, it's better to treat them as the feeders into the grid. And so we made that argument quite a few times. We were helpful in helping the airport here in Indianapolis install a rather large two-stage solar farm, which is now pushing energy back out to the grid beyond what the airport itself needs. And then we just, a few days ago, finished a study on brownfields to brightfields, which connects very strongly to the rural and urban context, because pretty much every piece of a county has some abandoned land that was once a factory or a place where batteries were produced or whatever, and these properties comprise elements of a Superfund site. And so what we've done is a study of the East Central Indiana area to look at how those properties can be converted to solar farms as a way to both not disturb the soil so that the pollution doesn't get agitated, but also to turn the property into something useful. And that avoids, to some degree, questions that were raised earlier about the visual effect. Of course, the history of power development in the country was that the big transmission lines went in without getting any prior visual approval, if you will, from landowners or communities. Because solar is a more distributed thing, the idea of participants in the local community having a say is now a more prominent fact. But we think that turning a brownfield into a brightfield is a way to address that concern. So those are some of the areas in which we've been operating, and we're finding that it enables us to talk about all three dimensions, the economic impact, economic development, getting somewhat independent of the grid for some of your power, and the social dimensions of retaining and enhancing living in a rural community, because folks really like the smaller scale, walkable environment if they can find a way to live an ethic there. And then certainly the environmental benefits attributed to green power. With regard to the campus here, just a real quick note, we have a 7 million square feet of buildings, 47 buildings altogether. We put in a district scale ground source geothermal heat pump chiller system, and we now have all 47 buildings connected. So we're running the whole campus as a big leaf, if you will. We're pushing heating and cooling out to the campus and pulling it back, and then we're using the earth as a battery or a thermal battery, if you will, to store excess heat or to pull heat or cool when we need it. And it's knocked our electric consumption down. It's knocked our energy bill down about $2 million a year, and we're looking at about a 12-year payback, which is roughly 8% on the marginal investment to make the geothermal project operational. So I can answer questions about that, but that's just my quick summary. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much. Okay, Michael, yeah, I know you just arrived here a little while ago. Why don't you talk a little bit about what's going on over in Kentucky?
Tennessee?
Yeah, the right state.
Yeah. Okay. Michael Walton, I'm the executive director of Green Spaces. We're a sustainability nonprofit based in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I would say, I could echo everything that everybody said so far. All of that, I would say, rings pretty true here. I guess a couple things that I haven't heard people talk about yet, maybe I just missed it, were the USDA REAP grants. Have you guys, that's been a huge boon in terms of renewable energy in rural communities here. I know a lot of our solar installers, a huge part of their work has been local farms that are making use of the REAP grants in addition to the the federal tax incentives. We don't have any local incentives, but the USDA REAP grant has been definitely a big engine in terms of getting rural landowners and farms to make those investments. I mean, and this sort of leads into the next thing that I haven't heard people talk about as much, which regardless of the sort of political perspective in at least in our part of the country, one relatively ubiquitous sentiment among rural communities is the idea of self-reliance. And so that's definitely a useful persuasion technique here to, you know, to frame renewable energy, even if it's being sold back to the grid and there isn't storage that's installed at the same time. The idea that, you know, they can do that in the future if they haven't already done it is usually extremely attractive. The selling point that, you know, you can be self-reliant. And this is, I guess, I mean, a lot of our work has been more, individual owners doing things for themselves. We don't have a lot of utility scale solar happening, and a lot of that has to do with TVA. So we have the federal behemoth that is the Tennessee Valley Authority, who is maybe 20 years ago were, you know, making quite a few investments and doing a lot of good things in the renewable energy space. But the current leadership is trying desperately to sort of stick their head in the sand and pretend like it's not coming. And so, which is interesting because TVA, because of the makeup of their portfolio, having large hydro and having a lot of nuclear, they were well ahead of the requirements of the Clean Power Plan, and they've seen their usage over the last 10 years flatten where they had it sort of expected it to increase. And so that sort of sent them into a policy tailspin when it comes to the renewable buyback rates, and it's posed a pretty big burden to people that want to do something like a community solar project on a brownfield that would support low-income households. You know, their reaction to that is basically, we don't need the generation, we don't want it, so, you know, we'll give you 2 cents a kilowatt hour. Good luck. And, you know, you can imagine the effect that that has on the pro forma of a community solar project. So I would say that's sort of the two, strong points that I would say that are good arguments are the USDA REAP grants and then the more cultural sort of self-reliance. I think both of those are embodied in the fact that the president of the local Tea Party has, I think, a like 50 kW solar array on their farm. But then the big hurdle we face is really from the fact that the state of Tennessee has no regulatory authority whatsoever over our utility because it's federal. That's all I got.
Okay, all right. So I want to ask one question here. I see one person from 919. Would you please identify yourself? Nine one nine two two five three nine six seven. Would you want to tell me? Oops, sorry. I guess you have to be unmuted first, don't you? Hang on here. Let's try that. All right. So, who are you at 919-225?
I don't recognize that number. This is Evan Hughes. I'm using Skype.
Okay.
Okay. I'm not on Skype.
I got you, Evan. There's somebody else here, too, that's on that 919 number. Who is that?
Yeah, this is Kathy Kaufman from Orange County, Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you, Sierra?
Yeah, I'm glad you could make it. I just couldn't tell who you were. So,
okay.
Right, super. All right, so we're going to open this up to questions right now. And Richard, is it Reifstein? Is that how you pronounce your name? He's a new member here, and he's done some very interesting things over in Boston. But, Richard, do you want to add anything to this conversation?
I just want to say I really enjoyed it, and I want to mention that I'm trying to do a project with the State Department of Environmental Protection doing just what Michael just talked about, get community solar on a brownfield to not only just turn it into a bright field, as Robert mentioned, but also to support local low-income populations. We're very interested in that idea. There's only one guy at the state who's doing this, but he's been pretty effective, so we're excited about working on that project. Can I also mention that I have someone with me here? Her name is Jamie Banks, and she is the head of Quiet Communities, and we're working on leaf blowers and the two-stroke engines, which are enormously polluting, and the issue of noise, and we think that that belongs in the agenda for clean energy on the local level as well. So I just want to put it out there.
Okay. So let's get back to talking about how do you go to a community? What do you say to them in order to get them involved? And, you know, who is going to do this? Who are the people that are going to be out there in the communities to move some of these things forward? Anybody?
So this is Jason in Buffalo, and this is exactly – we are the entity essentially that goes out into communities and talks about the value and benefits of renewable energies, and not just renewables, but also, you know, energy efficiency, reduce, you know, tracking your energy usage, realizing what buildings you own that are, you know, large consumers and addressing those to reduce your energy, and then to start to, you know, create policies in a climate to install renewable energy. And a lot of times the issue, how we do it is really, you know, what is the self-interest of that community? Where are they? What are their objections? And then try to help overcome those objections. Because I don't really feel like there's a one-size-fits-all, but it is about going out into the community and listening to where their concerns are and trying to address those concerns in a way that kind of validate those concerns, but also show the other side of the coin that, you know, large-scale solar might not be this big monster that you're fearing that it is. It can actually have benefits of to your community by either, you know, bringing in lease money to a municipality for, you know, allowing an installation to be built on municipal land or allowing farm owners to, you know, gain money that they might not have been getting from selling crops through, you know, selling energy back, right? Like, I think every community, there has to be a different solution for every community, because the reasons that folks aren't buying into this are oftentimes varied, and sometimes they're buried in a political argument, but if you can, you know, work your way around that to get to either, you know, a lot of times the financials of it show that it makes sense for them, or it's going to, you know, allow them to bring in new business by, you know, providing cheaper electricity for a data center or something like that. You know, like I think those are some of the approaches that we've tried to use here in Western New York that have shown some success in rural communities, which in general I think have been just a challenge for us to even get our foot in the door. But, you know, sitting down and having a conversation with somebody face-to-face about the issues that they perceive, and then kind of helping them work through some of those issues and getting some wins on some other things first that might not be renewables, but maybe like energy reduction or helping them see that they can save money by addressing energy issues in their town, I think is a big benefit to helping them gravitate towards renewables.
Well,
So this is Sherry.
Go ahead.
I'm in my car, so I hope my feedback's bad.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Yeah. Go ahead, Sherry.
But I just, when you talk about large scale, we don't, around here, we don't have any local projects except what we would call a big community solar project that's more than a megawatt. What are you referring to, just for point of reference?
So right now, the town of Grand Island, for instance, who's not necessarily a rural community, they're just second ring suburb, but they're installing 6 to 8 megawatts over the next year in their community.
Oh.
So we're talking large scale generation for the municipality to leverage that for both themselves, their residents, and the industry, right? So they're doing several megawatts at a time.
I would probably push back on that a little bit. Just
do you want to introduce
scale.
Yourself, please?
Sorry,
this is
Michael
please.
Michael Walton.
Okay, super. Thank you.
So I mean, I would still say, I mean, anything under like 10 megawatts, I would put in the sort of, you know, smaller scale community solar bucket. I mean, large scale in terms of these utility scale installations are like, you know, 100 or 200 megawatts of solar or wind. So when I say large scale, that's more the scale that I'm talking about, at least personally.
This is David K.
Yeah, we don't have that scale in Wisconsin. But I do want to say that in a rural area here, we had a business, a very big business in our county that has a lot of farmland. What they did is they put the solar arrays up on up high so that a tractor could actually go under it, and they're still farming the land.
Oh, wow.
I thought I'd put that out there.
This is David Kay at Cornell again. I think one of the things that this discussion highlights is what type of perspective people are taking on renewables and the role of renewables in their energy supply. So in New York, we're in a state that has a policy commitment over the next 12 years to get 50% of our electricity supply from renewables. We have negligible portions of that coming from solar right now, and there would be very, if the state is going to meet those goals, it will have to develop lots and lots of solar at multiple scales. In New York, we have, you know, in some sense, large is in the eyes of the beholder, but in a regulatory sense, anything over 40 megawatts is large enough that it actually goes to a state siting board as opposed to local siting, which makes a huge difference in terms of this dynamics of rural versus non-rural energy use and whether it's used locally or not. So I think that the question of scale, both of individual facilities and in the scale of change that you're looking at and shifting out of fossil fuels into renewables, is critical to think about and when we talk about these things.
Yeah, this is Kathy Kaufman from North Carolina, and we actually have we're actually second in the country for utility scale solar installations, and a lot of that has been a result of a lot of combination of a renewable portfolio standard that passed in 2007 when we had a much more progressive state government, but also because there's a lot of cheap farmland and farmers that want to stay on their land, and there's also it's been very difficult for our now regressive state legislature to get rid of that renewable portfolio standard because there are a lot of Republicans now that are very in favor of solar because people in their districts, I'm sorry, have made a lot of money, and it's been a big employer in the state. So it's sort of entrenched now, which has been really helpful. One thing we're trying to do currently, though, in terms of smaller scale, is we've got faith leaders from around the state who are banding together to try to get our behemoth, Duke Energy, to install, come up with a program of low-cost solar for churches, synagogues, whatnot around the state. And we'll see what happens with that. But that's been a real avenue for us. And maybe that's a product of living in the South, but it's a real avenue because because they're listened to. And I'll shut up after that. I'll stop with that. But I think we have more in common with the gentleman from Tennessee who talked about self-reliance being a really strong rural value. That's extremely true here, and it's been a real boon to people's view of solar because that's how they view it, and they view it positively because of that.
I think faith-based, this is Sierra, I think faith-based communities is instrumental in making a lot of changes in the southern part of the country. And I'm real impressed with what you're doing over there as far as that's concerned. And then the question is, how do you get them involved in this in the first place? You know, what are the arguments there to get them past some of the, policies that they have right now?
Well, we have a lot of forward-thinking churches as well, and we also have a lot of African-American churches who are very interested in rural development, and that's a big part of it.
Okay, I think that's extremely important. Anybody else?
This is David. I can jump in again just about the, you asked earlier who can go ahead and talk about this. I mean, I would, in many states, certainly in ours, and not in every county, but in a number of counties, there's the cooperative extension system and the farm, you know, the various farm organizations like the Farm Bureau. You know, they're organizations that have respect and influence in rural communities are really important to bring on board, you know, to be able to think about these issues in ways that will enable them to communicate effectively with the people that they, you know, that trust them. And I will add that, like, right now, one of the huge potential concern, I'll just put one of the huge concerns, I think other people have mentioned this already, but one of the huge concerns is the potential competition between agriculture, production agriculture, and solar. And there are, even though I don't think it's quantitatively a huge big deal in some places, there's no question that there are people concerned about preserving farmland and farming that are anxious about how much land might be taken out of agriculture for solar and what are the implications of that. So there are people looking for information about this.
Sherry's mentioned about having the solar panels high enough they can farm underneath it, I think is an extremely interesting concept.
So there, you know, the National Renewable Energy Lab is doing research on whether that, you know, actually makes sense or not, and I'm sure they're doing work all over the country. They've just started to do a project here in our county like that. But, you know, there are tax implications for this in terms of tax, you know, the existing tax breaks for farmers and so on that are very important. There's not enough hard information about what's feasible and what isn't right now.
So this is Sherry. Before I park, I just want to say the other thing we didn't talk about is bioenergy. We have a lot of farms in Wisconsin. And, you know, you do in New York as well and other places, dairy farms and have a manure. And a biodiversity is another big area, not only so much for the energy as a way to keep the water in good quality, but obviously energy is being used. And now we're having actual businesses buy the energy from rural digesters that want to go to zero net carbon.
Evan, do you want to weigh in on that? You still here?
I haven't heard that. I like that idea of a business actually buying directly, presumably at a higher price than it gives a retail price structure, which would help a lot. I haven't heard of that, but I'm intrigued by it. What I have heard about is farmland that's being taken out of production in California due to water supply uncertainty and is being held for other potential uses, and it needs to have some way to get revenue during the time that it's not producing as farmland. And I'm wondering, I heard that that's being thought of, I think, in New York State, and I'm wondering what price of solar is required to make some of these projects on farmland possible.
Well, I actually think it's less. It's my understanding from solar, from the solar industry. This is David again in New York. Is that the critical factor? Obviously, price is very important, but there are critical barriers in, you know, deciding between on farmland, not on farmland, or on the productive part of the farmland versus the less productive part of the farmland. That question often relates to access to the utility lines and to the substations and what capacity they have. So there is a general environment which is very important about the that obviously drives the economics about prices, but the actual site selection, given that there's a generally favorable pricing system, is often driven by access to the grid.
Oh, this is Evan. Yes, that's true. And in California, the interconnection charges to get onto the grid have been big barriers for projects that are small, and biogas digesters would be a prime example of that. But I think even megawatt solar might be too small to afford a good connection to the grid.
Right, and I think there is a more general question about biomass. I didn't, the previous speaker's voice is breaking up, so I didn't hear it all, but, I think the economic issues there, have been and remain challenging for a lot of sources of biomass. I remember working on, wood chips and wood energy 30, 40 years ago, and there's always been potential for that, and working a little on switchgrass as a source of energy from underutilized lands, and these things are all feasible, but usually not economic, at least in our part of the state, except in very specialized circumstances. And part of that's because the price of, the price you can sell the energy for is low.
Richard Reichstein, is that you who was talking about the anaerobic digester?
No, I wasn't talking about the anaerobic digester.
Okay, there's somebody I was talking to yesterday, or a couple of days ago, I can't remember who it is now, that was discussing how the university, I thought it was you, actually had an anaerobic digester that they, somebody else on one of the farmlands not too far away actually put it up there, and they were selling the energy then to the local city. I'll see if I can find that person again and bring them in.
I don't know, this is David again. I don't know how. Sorry, go ahead.
Sierra, you had me pegged for talking about community choice aggregation.
Right. No, I know that for sure. I don't want to get into that right now because that's something I'd like to have you in on a conversation with Samuel Golding. The really interesting things going over on in Massachusetts with Richard's school over there. University or community choice.
Sierra, this is Baird Brown. I worked closely with a manufacturer of methane digester equipment for farmers a while back, and at the time what was true was that there was a very sharp drop-off in there were very strong efficiencies of scale. So that under 1,000 head of cattle, it was pretty difficult to make something actually work financially. And even if you've got three farms right together and you can use conveyors, that might work to expand the scale. But as soon as you start putting manure into trucks, you're eating an awful lot of the gains. So it's an incredibly useful and valuable technology, but it you know, last I knew, it wasn't working in smaller settings.
And this is David again. That's been my experience too over the years. It's economies of scale, it's capital intensive, so you need scale economies. And the other thing has been that, although I may be out of date on how large the scales are for sure, but the other thing is at least in New York, the most interest in anaerobic digestion in agriculture was driven by waste disposal concerns, manure handling concerns, not by energy generation was a, you know, kind of a nice byproduct, but it was really driven by decisions about how do we manage the manure. I don't know if that was your experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Somebody just disappeared. Maybe it was me.
This is Baird one more time. Just a comment on what several people have raised there about the barriers to entry at the local level. To not be initially discouraged, there are an awful lot of avenues that are available in various states. For instance, New York, which was one that came up, has a provision in the law that basically allows a qualified facility, so that's any renewable energy or cogeneration facility, to sell electricity across its own wires to sort of nearby customers. It's a very vague provision, but it's available, and that's one of many examples of sort of loopholes you can find to make things work.
What do you mean by on your own wires in that case?
In other words, you can the cogeneration or renewable energy facility can deploy its own wires to serve those immediately surrounding customers, rather than having to go through a grid connection.
Thank you.
Eric, can utilities prevent that in certain states?
Oh, yeah. In Kansas, you can't sell one electron to the landowner on his own land. I mean, you just got to look state by state at what the law gives you. In California, a local co-op would be a very effective thing. Not so much in New York.
I was looking more at for personal individual use or community use if they all had buy into that.
In North Carolina.
Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
In North Carolina is one of three states that prohibits third party sales, so we can't do any of that. We keep trying to change that, but
well, at least they're putting up solar over there, which is better than some states can say.
Yeah.
So, any more comments? We're about to wrap this up. It's getting pretty close to the end of the hour here. All right. I'd like to focus on community choice aggregation next time, partly because of the conversation I had with Richard Redstein over at Boston University. And his students have done some very interesting studies on that. So I'll talk to Richard and see if we can get him to participate in that, set up a time, get him and Samuel Golding, a couple other you folks together interested in community choice. But anyhow, unless there's any other comments right now, any last thoughts? No. Okay. Well, thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks to the panelists for participating. And I'll be sending something out for January. We won't have any more this month. and hope to see you all then.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Sierra.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Sierra.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye, Sierra.